Okay, tonight is December 2nd. This is the fourth lecture in season 7, which is the 1500s. I think last week we finally got into the 1500s. We spent a lot of time at in the 1490s. And I guess that really, really set the tone for the 1500s. Last week, we really spoke about Portugal. And we spend most of the time speaking about the experience of the Jews in Portugal. And just one thing that came to mind, at least from all the exiles that we were talking about. Let's put aside Germany for now, because the German exile was always a lot of city states, and they're just really going from one side of the street to the other. Or one side of one country to another, but very, very local. In I believe it was the 1200s, the Jews were exiled from England, and when they were exiled there, so the king, the government, was very careful that no Jews could be harmed, and the Jews were allowed to leave with all their money. And as a matter of fact, there was one captain that played games, and the tide was low, and told the Jews to go out and walk around. And then when the tide came, he actually left without the Jews. And this was one incident that happened in England, and he was actually punished, the captain. I think he was killed even. He was punished for what he did to the Jews. So the Jews were exiled, and they were exiled. It was not right what they did. The English government at least felt that they didn't need the Jews anymore, so they sent them. But they sent them out with their money and with their lives. They just, free passage, making sure that everything was safe. Just the next, I don't know if it was actually the next, but the next exile that we spoke about was Spain. So Spain, they were allowed to leave unharmed without their money. So just the difference between England and Spain. Also, England, there aren't that many Jews. And in Spain, we don't know, anywhere between 100,000 to 300,000 Jews, but they were not allowed to leave with money. Again, they were allowed to leave unharmed, basically. They were allowed to leave unharmed, but so at least for the Spanish government, they didn't touch them or hurt them. They just said, you got to leave your money here. But when they got on the boats and everything, they were treated very, very poorly, and they had a hard time of it. This is really what we're in the middle of. We're going to learn, see today, that there were boats that just took advantage of them and took their money, sold them as slaves, just let them off on deserted islands, very terrible things. But the Spain itself allowed them to leave unharmed. And we saw last week, we heard the first of all these Spanish places where the Jews went, where most of the Jews went was Portugal. So they didn't even let them leave. You just see to what differences, how they start, they didn't want the Jews to leave, and they forcibly converted all of the Jews, whether they did terrible things like they took their kids away from them, or they starved, locked them up in a house for 3 days until they said yes, or they just forcibly took them to the baptismal whatever and forcibly converted them that way. But that was how Portugal ended up with, just to see the different levels in what they did. Now, I just wanted to make, I don't want to go really, we did Portugal last week, but there was one or two things I just wanted to point out, just something to follow through in history. But again, what we did see in Portugal, which was very, very vicious, how Portugal, actually the king, in order to try to get them to convert, they were there for two kings, King John, Jao, and then King Manuel. So King Jao, they came in 1492, King Jao died in 1495. So for the first 3 years that they were there, they were under King Jeho. And King Jeho, in order to try to get them to convert, he just took away 700 of their kids and said, you can get them back if you convert. And I heard numbers 600, 800, but and just ripped them away from their families and sent them to some deserted island off the coast of Africa, where most of them died right away. Eventually, there's going to be a settlement there, and they're going to send Jews there later. And to this day, there are descendants of those original Jews that were sent there. So that's like one thing that the Jews experienced. Also, King Manuel in 19... first, he was more sympathetic to the Jews. He freed those that were slaves by King John. But eventually, when he was Reda Shidduch with the daughter of Fernadette and Isabella, the terms of the marriage was that Spain had to be Judenrein. They had to be all Jews off. So the Jews were ready to leave. Listen, we left Spain. We'll leave you too. And that's when he forcibly converted everybody. He was given advice from the Jews there that had already converted. And they advised him, well, take their kids and they'll... happened twice, two times. This is second. This is under Manuel, not under John. John just took 700 kids.
They're saying they were converted. Now, I don't think a child between the age of four or 14 really knows. I mean, they're sprinkled with some water, Now you're a convert.
Right. So the whole thing was a sham. The whole thing was a sham. In their Christian world, I don't know how they view this sham. I'm sure if you speak to a rational Christian today, they'll say, yes, it is a sham. But I don't know how they viewed it in the 1500s. I don't know how they, if that was, Megaglin Schuss, Zachen Li Adam Shal Bafanov. That's what we would, we have that if we, a person adopts a child, a four-year-old, even younger. So the child is brought up as a Jew, and you're right, at the age of 13, you know, 12, if it's a girl, she has to reaffirm that she wants to be a Jew. So, maybe they did that also. I don't know. But overall, the Christian church, in Rome, was against this type of forced conversions overall, in general. So this was a local, like Portugal, thing to do with the local church. And Manuel couldn't care less if they were Christian or not. He just wanted to keep the Jews. He needed their minds. He needed their expertise. They were artisans. They were bankers. They were middle class, and they needed a middle class. This is what he did. Finally, after the Pesach, before they had to leave, he took as many kids as he could. He says he'll get them back if you agree to convert. And then as the Jews were leaving, they were told they could only leave through out of Lisbon. And he again just locked them all up in a room until they were starving. And I guess most of them at that point agreed to convert. And it was just horrific, just inhumane what he did to these people. And then he didn't allow them to leave. When did they leave? You want to say top it all off. This is 1497, about 7-8 years later. This we mentioned also the Lisbon massacre. Some Christians said they saw some image of Yashka, and some Jewish convert there said, "What are you talking about? Did you take your medication today? I mean, something like that, And that didn't go well. And that caused a terrible, terrible massacre there in Lisbon. It was, thousands of Jews died. But after that incident took place, they allowed Jews to start leaving. They went to the king. They said, look, you can't protect us. And it was... the Christians was killing the Jews because they realized the Jews were insincere. And the Jews, in fact, most of them were insincere. They were forcibly converted. They never wanted to. They didn't realize. These were the Jews. These were the firm Jews that left Spain. So these were the strongest Jews. And they would have left had you allowed them to leave. They were on their way out. And, okay. So this is where we left off. And I wanted to make just a few connections. This is pretty much where we left off yesterday. And throughout this time, the Jews from Portugal for the next 30 some odd years would be slowly but surely getting out of Portugal. If they ended up in Western Europe, they were known as the Spanish Portuguese. Or if they went east, they most likely, more often than not, they ended up in the Ottoman Empire, where they became Sephardic Jews. Sephardic Jews. Today, the Sephardic Jews of today probably are those that came through the Ottoman Empire route, which we may yet get to today. Okay, I wanted to make a just what happened to Portugal. At the time, in 1492, 1493, Portugal was cutting-edge technology in exploration. They had Prince Henry, who was known as Henry the Navigator, opened up a navigating school. And this navigating school would get the best maps for world exploration. And when I talk about maps, is world maps, sky maps. They got the best instruments in how to measure time and length through the stars. Stars, you could do two things with the stars. You could it tells you where your position is, because you're based on stars, and also tells you time. You could tell time through the stars. Somebody once taught me how to tell time through the stars, and it has to do with the North Star and the Small Dipper, that if it's in a certain position on one of the equinoxes, it's like 6 o'clock at night, and then as it keeps moving, it's another 5 or 10 minutes. So basically, if you knew the stars, you were able to pretty much, if you were an expert, you know what you saw the stars, you could know what time it is. Today, our cities are so light you can't see stars, but in those days, wherever you went, you were able to see all the stars. So shipbuilding, types of ships. The Portuguese had a type of ship, I forgot the name, also very, very well-built ships, and they were cutting edge. As a matter of fact, when they, in the early 1500s, they were like, they split all of South America with Spain, and there was like one of the latitudes, the agreement was that Spain gets to the western side of a certain latitude, and Portugal gets to the other side, and they did the same thing in Australia. I mean, these two were before anybody else, and they were cutting edge. They were the biggest explorers in the New World. So, like, what happened to Portuguese? What happened to Portugal? What happened to them on the scene? So basically, they were taken out. I think this is, I haven't seen anybody make this connection. This, I guess, is what I'm saying on my own. Just like, okay, what happened with Portugal? So there was in 1578. Hashem has all the time in the world he wants. So in 1578, this is about 80 years or so after the 80, 90 years after, you know, they first came to Spain, there was a certain, it's called the Battle of Three Kings. And basically, the king of Portugal, who was Sebastian, So basically, there was a war that was happening. It's all around the city. Again, it's called, where is the city? Kassar el Kabir. So this was the city. It was a battle, and basically what happened is the Ottoman Empire was coming all the way across to here. They were slowly but surely making roads into all of North Africa. And there was a ruler, and his name was Abu Abdallah Muhammad, or whatever his name was. And he was ousted by his uncle, Abd al-Malik, whatever it was. So this Abu Abdallah Muhammad, he went to Sebastian, and he says, "Can you help me get back my country?" And because, I guess it got very, very political, because Abd al-Malik was backed by Ottomans, and that was not good for the Spanish and Europeans, because the Ottomans were, first of all, different religion and very powerful, and so he agreed to back Abu Abd al-Muhammad, and he sent a force. Now, by the way, you could see how close this all is. This is where Morocco is, and this is the, I guess, Straits of Gibraltar. You see, this is Spain, and this is North Africa already. So, you know, if the Ottomans can get all the way to here, I mean, there goes your trade routes. You know, you want to be able to keep doing trade, and if you're going to have to pass through an enemy in a small area, that's not good for business. So he agreed. This was Sebastian, and basically what happened is he first attacked Tangier, which was more on the corner. Here's Tangier, and they were successful, and they made a beachhead into Morocco, and they said, "Yeah, we can do this. This is something we can do." So he decided to give his support, and he assembled a very large army. The army, again, 2,000 from Spain, just volunteers. He hired mercenaries from Flanders and Germany. The Germans, about 3,000 from there, 600 Italians, and then 500 ships. The army in total numbered about 18,000 men. I think that is just Spanish, Portuguese army. So his large army, plus, I'm not sure, it could be 18,000 was all of the Europeans, not including the army what Abu Muhammad had. So he all together was a very, very large army. So they came, and basically what happened is the battle went very, very south. Now, Abu Malik, the reason why it's called the Battle of the Three Kings, because all three kings would die. Everybody dies, and all leaders die. Sebastian, he dies, and his body is never even found. The Abu Malik, Abu Muhammad, whoever he was backing, he died also. The uncle was on his deathbed. He was very sick, and he got out of his bed to lead the battle. So he was victorious, but that was too much for him, and he died as well. So that's why it's called the Battle of Three Kings. But what ends up happening out of this is a total defeat for Spain, for Portugal. Portugal loses everything. First of all, 8,000 dead, including the nobility. I mean, who went to fight these wars? I guess like the knights. I don't know if they had such a thing back then. But from the nobility, many of them came. 15,000 were taken prisoners. 100 maybe survived. And the body of Sebastian was never lost. So this is the king. As a matter of fact, this was the last of the Aviz. This is it. After this, there's no more. Okay, so who took it over? So it was taken over by Spain. Spain, for the next 60 years, had control over Portugal. So until they... I'm sorry?
Sorry.
You want to go back to Sebastian, who led it?
Yeah. If his body was never found, how did they know he was dead?
I guess they saw him killed. He didn't make it out alive.
His body was never found.
Okay.
That's a big question.
All right. I guess so. But I guess enough people were there realized that he didn't make it out alive. Not too many people made out. Could it have been he was sold as a slave? Very possible. But somebody may have recognized him. If he escaped, he would have made his way back to Portugal.
I mean,
okay. Maybe. You never know. Maybe. Okay, what ended up happening with all this? So first of all, this is like, if you want to know the end of Portugal, this was it. So this was a battle. It was a poorly, the strategy of it was wrong. how he took so many. I mean, just Hashem puts it in the minds. Hashem controls the minds of kings. He did this. He lost the entire. So, but what was also interesting is 15,000 people were sold as slaves. Right? Now, when they were sold as slaves, again, North Africa, lots of slaves there, lots of slave owners. This was the culture there. You can buy yourself a slave. Who would you want to be a slave of? A Muslim or a Jew? So, of course, the Jews were much, much better masters in every and any sense of the word over Muslims. I mean, just... So these Portuguese noblemen that were taken as slaves, of course, who would they have wanted to become slaves to the Jews? And who were these Jews that were there? Many of these Jews were the descendants of Jews that were kicked out of Spain and Portugal. So, like, I guess almost like Hashem's, like, you know, sense of humor, the wheel turns, that these are the people that kicked the Jews out, and now they ended up hoping to become the slaves of these same Jews.
So the only Jews were kicked out of Portugal and Spain. They had to get back in.
No, they're in North Africa. They're being sold as slaves in North Africa. Yeah, Morocco. This is all in Morocco. So this is so again, this is just like just one of these connections that I myself made. Is like, okay, so that's it. For the next 60 years, Portugal is going to be like a sub-state or controlled by Spain itself until 60 years later there's going to be some sort of, a revolt or however it is, and Portugal is going to get its own independence again. But that was it. At that point, they're not going out, they're not doing any exploration. Whatever they have, and that was the beginning of the end. The Aviz dynasty is gone. He was the last king, didn't have any kids. So the kingdom of the family of John and Emmanuel finished by 1576. Nothing left. The kingdom in Portuguese, like nothing. It's a shadow of itself. Okay. The end of the Aviz dynasty, as I said. Okay. And 60 years under the Philippine dynasty with Spain. Okay, I wanted so we spoke so far, more than half the Jews ended up in Portugal because that was the most logical place to go. But you see how Hashem, you know, just he wasn't really that, he didn't want it to be that way, or that was not the end. You know, had Manuel not been offered to marry Isabella, what would he have done? Would the Jews been able to be continued as Jews? Maybe. Who knows what would have happened? But that wasn't meant to be. That was still part of this exile. Still part of what the Spanish and Portuguese Jews had to go through. But, and this we mentioned last time, there was a diary of an Italian Jew. This is, again, in 1495, he's writing this. So now he speaks of some of where the other people went. So some of them went to, in Italy, they went to the city of Ferrara, Romagna, I don't know if I'm saying it right. Maybe they went to the... I'm sorry?
Romagna.
That's Romagna, that's how you say it? Okay. The Patrimonium, which I think is... those are the states as the area owned by the Pope. And in Rome. Where else some of them ended up? That was if you made it. You made your way to Italy. Again, this is assuming that the captain of the boats that took these Jews didn't just take all their money and just throw them overboard, or throw them into the deserted island, or sold them as slaves. So if they made it to, some made it to Italy, those places. Some made it to Fez. Okay, this is, some made it, this is the North Africa. Some made it to Fez, which is nearby, is Morocco. I don't know how to say this word. Tlemcen? Huh?
Tlemcen.
Okay. Berber provinces, the king of Tunis. So, here you have to realize, so tens of thousands of Jews, thousands of Jews, if not tens of thousands of Jews, are coming to all these areas. The reports were at first they thought these people were coming to attack, you know, and it was one area that they actually set the army out until they heard the news. They said, no, they're not coming to attack. They were thrown out of Spain. They were thrown out of Spain, these refugees. And they said, oh, wow, okay. You know, so they put the guns back, you know, they put the swords back in. And but, so It depends on the place. Not every place willing to accept the Jews. some of them, they didn't allow them into the city, so they were outside the cities, and many of them died of hunger. This is all written in the diary of this person from Italy. Some, there were lions, bears, wild animals that may have killed them. These are the three countries where they are. So you could see where they are: Fez, Tlemcen, and Tunis. I just want to show you how Hashem runs the world. And this, at this point in 1492, these countries were not under the Ottoman Empire. In 1492, these were still under the different dynasties that were there. They were Muslim, but they were independent. These small little country kings that they were there. Some of them, they did better in some of them than in others. Some of them they just left them outside, and in many of these places there was a sickness, plague followed them, and that's in one place. That's why maybe they didn't allow them in the city. There was another place where after they were settled, there was a fire, and then they lost all their possessions in the fire. It wasn't like they came to these cities and they were all, you know, that's it. It was over. They had a hard time getting assimilated, getting into the cities. The Jews that were there in all these cities did everything they could to help them. But I just want to show you something. Now, this is the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is going to be the hero of the day. When we say that Hashem makes the refuah before the machla, the healing before the sickness, so the Ottoman Empire is going to be that refuah before the machla. But just to show you where it was, in 1481, 10 years before the expulsion of Spain, this is what the Ottoman Empire looked like, just a little bit around Asia Minor. That's where it was. And, yeah?
Was it also in Eretz Israel also?
In 1481, no. In 1566, this is what it looked like.
Wow.
So 1481 to 1566 is what, 85 years? In 85 years, they just swept the boards. But what comes to mind to me is even in the 1520s, they already started taking North Africa. Had the Ottoman Empire taken North Africa before the expulsion of Spain, the Jews would have had a much easier time in all of these areas. Because wherever the Jews were, the Sultan, the Sultan, the leader of the Ottoman Empire, sent firmans out. He sent letters out to all the governors everywhere. You make sure that your Jews are taken in and well cared for. So if the Jews made it to the Ottoman Empire, they were well cared for. They were well taken care of. We'll see what they did with the Jews and why they wanted the Jews and everything. But by the way, the fact that it went from this to this had a large part to do with the Jews. You know, I know. I guess we could just make a little bit mention here is that the Jews, I know, were into everything, but part of the technology the Jews were into was into gunpowder. So the Jews came to the Ottoman Empire and taught them how to make guns, I guess gunpowder, which very much helped them, you know, besides filling a need and being... Making the business and the merchants and it just very, very, very well went with the Ottoman Empire. And the leaders of the Ottoman Empire were very, very far-sighted. They did things that were very, very smart for empire building. They knew they could trust the Jews because they knew the Jews, no way in the world would the Jews ever want to take over the government. You know, you got another tribe, a Muslim tribe, and you know, maybe, you know, gotta watch your back. But with the Jews, there's no, not even a havamit on that. You know, all right. So I just wanted to just point out that you see, you know, had just, I guess, you know, it was bashert, but this is the other way, you know, in terms of for the Jews having it hard. That exile in 1492, again, had it been 20 years later, they would have had closer to them, they would have had safer shores to go to.
Question, M-O-O-R-S-O-R-V.
The Moors were a group in North Africa. I think is that Morocco? The Moors, those were...
Moors is just a name for Arabs.
An Arab tribe. A general name for Arabs?
Generic name for Arabs.
Okay, then... Okay, so that's what it is. I thought they were a certain tribe, because it does say when the Moors came to Spain, so I didn't realize that they're talking about Arabs in general.
I recently saw an article where they were talking about, you know, that one of the British princes is marrying an American.
Okay, yeah.
Some black heritage. They were saying that the British had like one of their queens was like descended from the Moors, like she had also like some.
So I guess some queen was from Arabs.
Portugal, like they married and everything, but they seem to indicate. I thought it meant that Moors meant like black.
Okay, could be. I don't know, but the Muslims were black Muslims as well, because Muslims already in the 700s, late 600s, they swept the boards. Everybody became Muslim in Spain or in North Africa. They mainly stayed Muslim. You know, from the 600s, it was never conquered again by the Christians. Just that the original caliph, that all fell apart, so then they became smaller provinces. Okay, here he brings down in, this was in Tlemcen. It was Avram, a Jew named Avram, and he spent a lot of his own money to help get the Jews in and acclimated, and the Jews of North Africa overall, they were very good to them. And there were those that had such a hard time, you know, they weren't allowed in the cities, and then afterwards there were plagues. I mean, these are those that made it to the cities. A lot of the people, the kings of the cities, the governors, whatever they were, did not allow them in, and they were outside the city, and they had a hard time. There was plagues, and there was one place a fire, not too many, but there were some that said, "All right, they went back. They went back to Spain, and they converted. They gave in. Not too many." And this is the diary of this Jew. He writes, you know. Fulfillment of Eicha, and whatever. Okay, he also says that very few became converts, and that we know from our other sources as well. Okay, this is something where he continues, and I made my own connection, which also puts something into perspective for me. He says, he's continuing in his diary, and he's writing about, you know, the expulsion from Spain, and he writes, vessels came from Genoa, as I'm saying it right, in Italy. I think I have it here. That's where Genoa is. You know, the same. That's where Genoa is in Italy. It's like all the way on the western side, all the way towards the top. Okay, so that's where Genoa is. So he says vessels came from Genoa to Spain to pick up some Jews. You know, we'll take them. You know, I guess whatever they charge. I don't know how you book passage but they know that. So the crews of these vessels also acted maliciously, robbed them, and delivered them some to the famous pirate of the time, who was called the Corsair of Genoa. All right, I wouldn't have made too much of it, except I'll tell you in a second. Those who escaped and actually arrived in Genoa, the people there acted terribly to the Jews. All right, that's what he writes. So I just Googled Corsair of Genoa, and I got this. I got this, and it seems that Andrea Doria, if I'm saying his name correctly, you read his life, the admiral from Genoa, you read from his life that what he did, he was for the Charles of Naples, and he went to, he joined the Order of Knights to Jerusalem, and then in 1503, he was by Louis the 12th, and he now had 8 galleys, And then 1507, 1597, he had a whole fleet, and he overpowered the Barbary corsairs and the some big captain he overcome. Then 1524, he put a blockade on Marseille. And then he had a problem with the King of France, so he went back to Charles V, and he was just had such a remarkable career as an admiral. I mean, he had a phenomenal army and fleet, and he was helping kings, and you know, he organized the fleets for everybody. All right, and he was absolute head of the naval forces in the House of Austria, and it just goes on. 1532, he. Solomon the Magnificent. So he did some warring against him, and he helped with a siege in Tunis. I mean, like, you know, his resume, you know, and he actually finished, and he at the end of his life he retired back in Genoa, and you know, he was royal hospitality. He was the royal. He had royal guests: Charles V, Philip II. He was like all the way up there. So when it says this is the person with his diary, he calls him they gave him over to the famous pirate, the Corsair of Genoa. What is he? I mean, and this is in 1495, right? This is in the very beginning before I just mentioned everything. So it does look like when you read his biography, it says in 1487 to 1492, he was part of a condottieri is a leader or a member of a troop of mercenaries, especially in Italy. So the first 5 years of his life, he had a bunch of boats, and he was a pirate. He got off on the foot of some sort of a famous pirate, to such a point where the boats from Italy, from Genoa, handed him over to this Andrea Doria, and that's how he was known from here. He robbed them and delivered them to the famous pirate who was called the Corsair of Genoa. Now we all know them. He's a medal. He's a hero in Italy. He was like, you know, he did a lot, but that's how he started his career of taking Jews and selling them. And okay, huh? Oh, well, okay. Which ship? America?
Oh, the Andrea Doria.
Oh, really? Who? Yeah. America?
Sure, yeah. No, it cracked. Two boats crashed into each other.
And one of them was?
That one sunk.
And the Andrea Doria. When was this? 50s, possibly. 1950s? 50s
or 50s.
Okay. All right, maybe I will. I don't know. Maybe I saw it. I realized this is 1950. I want to be. I'm back. I'm not there yet. He goes on. This is another sad story. They made it to Sicily. Sicily is really all on the bottom. And in fact, the king was friendly with the Jews. He received them, merciful to them. The Jews of Naples, again, Naples is this area all over here is Naples. And they supplied food to the Jews that made it there. Okay, they supplied the Jews that made it there. The Muranos who were there already, lent them even the Dominican Brotherhood, who were generally anti-Semitic, had Rachmanis on these Jews. But
did
what happened?
Huh? Did they establish
shuls
and everything?
Sure,
and schools and everything.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it, especially in the Ottoman Empire. I mean, wherever they were, they established shuls, and they established their own shul because, you know, and we're going to see in the Ottoman Empire, every wave established their own shul. Because either they were not frum enough or too frum for the refugees from 20 years earlier or 10 years earlier. So each one, you know, that's it. They were little. They found themselves different than the group before. So yeah, it was a city in, I'm not sure if it's Anatolia, but there was a city in the Ottoman Empire that had one big city that had Jews, but they had like 20 shuls. Because each group had their own, you know, their own minion, their own, you know. Here in Sicily, where they had everything and they were getting money and they were being, and then a plague broke out. To such a point, the plague broke out and even went to Naples. So, a plague broke out and just again, you know, just a heartache again. The so hard of what happened. I think this should really go next, but. These are different other places where they went. They said they went to Romaine, Rome, Naples. Again, this was Naples, Sicily. They have Patrimonium. That's the Papal States. And I guess basically the end is the exiled Spaniards went over the sea to Turkey. Again, if you weren't thrown into the sea and killed and sold as slaves and you made it to Turkey, okay, Baruch Hashem. Then at that point, those were the Jews that made it the easiest transition and the quickest transition. Turks was a growing empire, as you could see. They started like as nothing, and they were for the next 80 years through Suleiman the Magnificent. They kept getting bigger and bigger. By the way, Suleiman the Magnificent. Do you know what he built? Anybody? Suleiman the Magnificent. The old city walls today in Yerushalayim. The old city walls were rebuilt by Suleiman the Magnificent. It was commissioned by him. He was there, he looked, he saw. And we'll talk about it when I get there a little bit. Okay, anyway, I have a few minutes. I just thought I would, before we get into the Ottoman Empire, because a lot's going to go on into the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire has a history with Jews from the very, very beginning. But just a little bit of a brief history of the Ottoman Empire. Muhammad dies in 632, and from then they have the time of the four caliphs. We did this a number of years ago. And once they leave the Arabian Peninsula, they just come on the scene and they sweep the boards. They just take country after country, and they convert people to Islam just like nothing. And it's very, very vibrant. They're doing a great job. This was from 632 to 650. This was the entire Muslim empire. Again, it started in the Arabian Peninsula under Muhammad. He dies, and then they just go all the way east into India. They go up to into the Black Sea, the Caucasus, the mountains up there. They get up until the Byzantine Empire. They took most of it. They take all of that North Africa. They come into Spain. 711 again. That's the Battle of Tours with Charles Martel. That was it. That was the last army. Had he fallen, Europe would have looked a lot different. The world would have been a lot different. But they held on. As you can see, Europe, which is in the yellow, still remains yellow. It still remains non-Muslim. The blue is the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantines, they were the biggest losers because they had all that area, most of the pink and the green, that was taken over by the Muslims. So this is 632. Ottomans are not around yet, but this is when the world becomes Muslim. 1215, then comes in another country, another empire. I grew up, we didn't spend too much time on this empire, but this is the Mongols. And the Mongols start in, they actually, in terms of land, they were the largest empire. There was no empire that was as large as the Mongols. As you can see, it starts all the way in China. They go all the way from the eastern shores of the Pacific, all the way they make it into Hungary. They also make it to the gates of Vienna. And they make it all the way down. They do not end up with Eretz Yisrael, but they get Asia Minor. They make it all the way to Constantinople. And Russia, this is all becomes the Mongols. And this is in the 1200s. They say that the Black Plague came from here in 1348. It originated somewhere here, and it made its way west into the... Okay, what then happens is this empire divides into different sections. And eventually they get weaker and weaker. And in 1299, one of the sects of Muslims is by the person by the name of Osman. And he begins to take a little bit of a piece of real estate. He gets himself a little country. And he starts to expand. And this is the Mongols are, they've been here long enough. They've been here, for a few hundred years. But they start losing now. And already in 1290, about 100 years later, whatever. So he starts a little bit. And it's the Ottoman Empire is named after Osman. That's Ottoman Osman. He's the one who started it. And he just kept eventually it's going to replace the Byzantine Empire. They're going to be 1453 is going to be a major battle, and they take Constantinople, which people thought was impregnable. I mean, he did a great job. He had a little bit of luck, but a lot of he knew what he was doing. Ottoman Empire is Islam. As they conquered places, churches turned to mosques. Very tolerant of Christians and Jews. As long as, again, you realize that the Muslims were number one, and you were able to take on yourself a dhimmi status, which means you're second-class citizens, you could do just fine. You could do what you want. You want to daven, you want to pray, you think, fine. You want to do business, you want to make money, fine. And it was very, the Jews had a very easy time of it. They're used to being, in Gullus, we're used to being second-class citizens. And everything was fine up until the 1800s, when the modern secular Jews, they wouldn't play second fiddle to anybody. And then you see what happens with the Muslims since then. But that's not till much later. This is a big mosque in Istanbul. Okay, the Janissary, one of the things that they had, very interesting, they had this army called the Janissaries, if I'm saying it correctly. And basically the Janissaries is, as they would conquer different countries, they would take the kids of these countries and make soldiers out of them. And they would enlist these kids in the army and train them to be soldiers. So at first they were very wary of this. But after a while, they realized that the Janissaries were really, they were looked up to. It was a chashuv thing to be in the Janissary. And then it almost was like people would send some of their kids to be, instead of it just having to be taken when you're conquered. So this Janissary eventually became a massive army, and eventually it became too massive. And the kings of Turkey were afraid of them and eventually had them all killed. They told the people to kill them, and then they're no longer. But at one point, it was a fierce army. This was the army that helped grow the empire. And this is where they got their people. They were not allowed to marry. And I think it was almost like the Secret Service. I think they... Originally, they were working for the Sultan himself. That was the Janissary. There are more modern pictures of the Janissary. Okay, big things. 1352, Sultan's able to cross over into Europe. That was 1352. 4 years after the Black Plague. That's just the Black Plague just ravaged Europe. Maybe that's why there was just nothing left to Europe. One third to a half of Europe was killed in a Black Plague. 1453 was a big, big, big year. The Ottoman Empire under, I forgot who, was it Bazayid Selim? I'm not sure which one, but conquered Constantinople, which was a major, major battle. The fact that Constantinople was very well fortified, that was Constantinople from the Roman times. When Roman Empire split, Constantinople was on one side, and the The Rome was for the west, as Constantinople was for the east. And when they conquered it over, they changed the name Constantinople to Istanbul, and that became the new capital of the Ottoman Empire. When they took that over, they needed people to populate the city. So they had actually forced Jews, they told from all over, to move to Istanbul. They forced Jews very often. This was not uncommon for them when they conquered a certain area. They felt that they needed people to live there, I guess, to be part of the, to fill the empire in, to make it good. So very often they would take Jews and they would force Jews to go to move to these places. And they forced a lot of Jews. I'm not sure if it was from the Greece area, but they forced Jews to move to Istanbul. And when they got there, the Jews did very, very well. And they were close to the government. We'll talk about some of the doctors soon. I'm just going the history before. And 1520 to 1566 was the peak power. That was Suleiman the Magnificent. After 1566, it slowed down. I mean, this was the same Ottoman Empire coming into World War I, 1914. It was the same Ottoman Empire. They were known as the sick man of Europe because it was just corrupt and ready to fall apart. And the British and French were keeping it up just so that Russia shouldn't take over that area. But after the Ottomans made a very big mistake and they came in on World War I on the side of the Central Powers, Germany and Hungary, and when they lost, so France and England divvied up most of their land among themselves, and that's how England ended up with Palestine. Do I have anything more here? Just different, you see different colors, how they acquired it. First it was the pink and the yellow, pink and the red, and then they became the yellow, and then the green, and then the light green, and then this is throughout the years, they kept acquiring more and more land. And just a different way of looking at it, same idea, but this was towards the end of the 1600s. Towards the end of the 1600s, this is what the empire looked like. It was a massive empire, one of the longest and most powerful empire for the longest time. I noticed they have Eretz Yisrael. So under Eretz Yisrael, we will also talk about a rejuvenation, a rebirth sort of Sfat, of Yerushalayim, Jews coming back. And okay, I guess maybe we'll just end it here. And what I want to, I guess, next week, just start with the Jews and the Ottoman Empire. So this is the Ottoman Empire. They opened their empire to the Jews. They needed the Jews. They wanted the Jews. They protected the Jews. And this is where the Jewish life, at least for the Sephardim, are going to continue for the next few hundred years. While this is happening, the Jews are Poland. It's just very interesting how also the Jews, we didn't get to them, but the Jews in Ashkenaz are all moving east to Poland. And it's around the same time that Polish Jewry is going to take off as well. So the whole world is in flux. Everybody's moving to the left, actually to the east, I should say to the left. And that's we'll end it here. Any questions or... All right, then, Mitzvah Hashem, tomorrow. Next week, I'm off. I'm making a Shabbaton for. I go to the Hollywood Kollel at night, and Wednesday nights I teach middle school boys. So Mitzvah Hashem, huh? And the next week is Chanukah after that, so we will probably be off for Chanukah as well, and so Mitzvah Hashem, I guess, in 2 weeks. All right. So, all right, Kol Tov. Take care. Thank you so much. I'll see you in 3 weeks, right? I'll see you, Mr. Shem. I'll see you in 3 weeks.